think, a really important moment for Pakistan, because this is really a decision by Pakistanis, for Pakistanis, about Pakistan.
A surprising decision by Pakistan's High Court leaves that nation tense. This is Thursday, the 1st of November, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of the program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Coming up, the United Nations disputes the latest plan to bring the Rohingya back to Myanmar. The U.S. indicts 10 Chinese, including two intelligence officers, on charges of stealing technology involving a jet engine. And we have the latest for you on the U.S. midterm elections. It's all on VOA Asia. Pakistan's Supreme Court Wednesday overturned the conviction of a Christian woman on a charge of committing blasphemy, a crime punishable by death under Pakistani law. The landmark ruling sparked protests by hardline Islamists and raised fears of violence. The prosecution has categorically failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, read the verdict in the case of Asia Bibi. Several Islamist parties rejected the verdict. One of them, the Defense of Pakistan Council, announced it will now take matters in its own hands. I asked Waris Hussain, policy analyst for South Asia with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, to explain what happened.
Essentially, what happened here is something that happens to a lot of religious minorities in Pakistan. There was some kind of a conflict, some kind of a fight, a war of words, so to speak, between Asia Bibi, who was essentially a field worker, and other field workers who were picking berries, essentially. And during this berry picking, there was an issue over the collection of water, the drinking of water. Sometimes Muslims, or some Muslims, say that I can't drink this from the same water source as a Christian. So there was an issue of that. And then there was a back and forth between Asia Bibi and two women from her village. And then those women took that personal sort of issue that didn't have anything to do really with religion, so to speak, but then they took that fight that they had to their local imam. The imam then went to file a first information report, which is essentially a criminal report, against Asia for committing blasphemy. She was beaten by her village, people within her village, after the accusation went out. Then she was arrested. She was charged in the Sessions Court. Then the Lahore High Court upheld that conviction and held her for the death sentence. And then finally, the Supreme Court stayed her execution in 2016. And then finally, in 2018, they've actually acquitted her of all charges, and she's now free to go and perhaps leave the country, even if she needs to.
Those of us in the Western world are accustomed to a separation of church and state. Is that not the case in Pakistan and many other places around the world?
No, especially not oftentimes in the Muslim world. Pakistan is technically and constitutionally designated as the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. So you can already see in the name and the branding of the country itself at its outset, it's not supposed to be secular, or the separation between church and state isn't quite how we see it in the West. And therefore, we do see that Sharia and Islamic law does have a sort of importance in the Pakistani political system, and also Islamic parties and Islamist parties have a very, very strong hold, not because they can get win elections necessarily, but they really have strong connections with major political parties that do win elections. And so they kind of dictate to those parties, here's what's possible for you as Muslims, here's what's not permissible for you as Muslims. And once they've said something's not permissible, it's very hard to convince them otherwise.
This is quite surprising in Pakistan, is it not?
It is quite surprising, also because in previous cases, when judges have acquitted people of blasphemy, or have sort of even the opposite, when a religious minority is attacked by a terrorist, even convicting that terrorist of a crime can actually endanger the life of judges. So here in this case, the Supreme Court justices, including the Chief Justice, as well as Justice Khosa, have taken an action that could potentially lead to them being attacked, whether in the public sphere or whether actually physically attacked by religious extremist groups. And it's happened before with judges in the past, where judges who have sort of come out in favor of religious minorities actually have to flee the country because they're so afraid of the response.
But what about Ms. Bibi? Is she in danger?
I think reasonably and rationally looking at this, absolutely she's in danger. I don't know exactly where she is right now. Hopefully, and I'm hoping, and I have no information on this, but I'm hoping she's out of the country because that's the best way to keep her safe. But definitely she's in danger. Her family and her extended family are also in danger. her attorney is also in danger, and also the Pakistani Christian community overall is in danger, because if oftentimes when the extremist groups can't get their hands on the person they want to get their hands on, they take out their aggression or violence on the community at large. So they'll go to a Christian village or neighborhood, burn it down, ransack it, loot it, if they can't find the one Christian that they were looking for. So in this case, if Asia Bibi has found safety, which I hope she has outside the country, there are still other collateral damage that might happen between her extended family, that many of them are still in Pakistan, and Christians overall in Pakistan who are still there.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan warned what he called a handful of protesters across the country not to take the state on over the landmark Supreme Court verdict. Did that surprise you, and does that put him in danger?
It absolutely surprised me. I think in some ways it does put him in danger, but he also has quite a lot of public support these days. And in fact, he has support amongst many young religious people, such that if he said this, they might listen to him over other religious extremist preachers who might be arguing against him in this instance. One thing I would sort of just mention is that this is, I think, a really important moment for Pakistan, because this is really a decision by Pakistanis, for Pakistanis, about Pakistan. You know, there's going to be accusations, and there have been accusations in the past, that any kind of progress that's been made or is made on religious minority issues, it's actually only being done on the behest of the United States or on Europe or et cetera, et cetera. But I think here what we have is the Pakistani Supreme Court, a very Pakistani institution, deciding something, the Prime Minister going along with it, and the police and security forces going along with it. So it's a completely, I think, really organic Pakistani development, and I think for that reason it should be really held as a really good example of where things can go in the future to try and change things and can try and make them more equal or fair for religious minorities. This isn't an outside influence that's being pushed on Pakistan. This is Pakistanis saying, we've got to do better, and we will do better.
Waris Hussain, policy analyst for South Asia with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top stories, the Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Rescuers pull three bodies and four survivors from a massive landslide in the Natonian province of the northern Philippines, with at least 18 still missing. South Korea's spy agency has reportedly observed preparations by North Korea for international inspections at several of its nuclear and missile test sites. Vietnam has set up a web monitoring unit that can scan up to 100 million news items per day for what it calls false information, a move that tightens its grip on internet freedom. The French news agency reports Thailand is rolling out plans to legalize medical marijuana, as that country hopes to cash in on a multi-billion dollar industry. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at VOA Asia and VOAnews.com. The U.S. Refugee Agency opposes a recent agreement between Myanmar and Bangladesh to begin repatriating thousands of Rohingya refugees in the coming weeks. The UNHCR says conditions are not conducive for the safe, dignified return of the refugees to a country they fled more than a year ago to escape persecution and violence. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The decision to begin the repatriation operation in mid-November comes about a week after UN investigators have warned of an ongoing genocide in Myanmar. Bangladesh reportedly handed over to Myanmar the names of more than 5,000 Rohingya refugees who had been processed for return. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahejic says Myanmar reportedly agreed to the list. He tells VOA the Bangladeshi authorities must inform the refugees of this transaction, and they must be consulted on whether or not they would like to return to Myanmar.
UNHCR was not involved in preparation, transmission, or receipt of this list, nor in the verification and clearing that was reportedly carried out by the government of Myanmar. Because we considered that conditions in Rakhine State are not yet conducive for voluntary return in the conditions of safety, dignity, and sustainability, UNHCR will not at this stage facilitate any refugee returns to Rakhine State.
More than 700,000 Rohingya fled to Cox's Bazar at the end of August 2017, in the wake of a brutal crackdown by the Myanmar military, including killings, rapes, and arson attacks. The United Nations reports Rohingya continue to flee Myanmar. It says more than 14,000 refugees have arrived in Bangladesh this year. The Rohingya have lived as a stateless people in Myanmar for more than six generations. UNHCR's Mahechit says it is up to the Myanmar authorities to create the conditions for refugee returns. He says that includes granting the Rohingya citizenship, freedom of movement, access to education, and other basic services and rights available to the rest of the population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An Afghan military helicopter carrying senior officers crashed in the western province of Farah early Wednesday, killing at least 25 people on board. A provincial government spokesman told VOA the aircraft went down in bad weather shortly after taking off from the mountainous Anardara district for neighboring Herat province next to the Iranian border. Taliban said its fighters shot down the helicopter. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. The United States Tuesday indicted 10 Chinese, including two intelligence officers, on charges of stealing technology involving a turbofan jet engine used in commercial aircraft from American and French aerospace companies through hacking into their computers. One of those charged is Xu Yanjun, deputy division director of the Jiangsu Bureau of the Chinese Ministry of State Security. He's been extradited from Belgium. A day before the Trump administration moved to cut off Fujian Jinhua Integrated Circuit, a Chinese-backed chipmaker from U.S. suppliers amid allegations of intellectual property theft involving Micron technology. Cedric Layton is a former Air Force intelligence officer who runs his own crisis management consultancy. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the hacking effort, which covered a period of 5 years, is the third espionage-related case brought by the U.S. Justice Department involving Chinese agents in a month.
Well, it's part of a big pattern that the Chinese have developed over the years to actually try to penetrate the most sensitive and commercially viable technologies in the West. Among these technologies are airplane technologies. In addition to that, of course, you have chip technologies, which underline basically all the things that we take for granted in this age of computers and age of ubiquitous connectivity. What the Chinese are doing is part of a national strategy to actually leapfrog their development process way ahead of where it would normally be. What that means is that they're able to go in and steal what's already been made by U.S., European, and other companies, and then use the technical innovations of others to make their technical innovations almost as good, if not as good, as their Western counterparts.
The new indictments detailed efforts to use malware and phishing techniques to hack into so-called target computers and remove the data on the engines and parts. What does that mean?
Malware is inserted into a target network. So what you do is you send a phishing email first. It will look like an email coming from a legitimate correspondent. The victim will click on that link. The victim, of course, is attached to the target network. And once the link is clicked on, then the malware can spread throughout the target network. And basically what they do is they use social engineering techniques to make their emails look like legitimate emails. Once that's done, it goes through the entire corporate network, and it then does a reconnaissance mission to figure out what the network looks like and where the important data lies within that network.
This comes just a day after the Trump administration moved to cut off a Chinese state-backed chipmaker from U.S. suppliers amid allegations the firm was stealing intellectual property from U.S. semiconductor company Micron Technology. What is the serious nature of this?
The chips that the Fujian Jinhua is making are so-called DRAM chips. And DRAM chips are really the backbone behind all of the technologies that we use in our cell phones, in our laptops, in our iPads. So what these chips do is they speed up the processing of the information that we want. They make the tablet or the computer or the cell phone work a lot quicker, and they allow it to process data at a much faster rate than would otherwise be possible. If you can process data at a really fast rate, and you can miniaturize that data processing capability, which is what a DRAM chip does, then you are able to not only produce consumer electronics that are useful throughout the world, but you're also able to produce computer systems that can process a lot of data. And the more data that you process, the more your profits are up. And that works, you know, for companies like Google or Facebook, but it also works for computer companies, and it is also a large component to burgeoning fields like artificial intelligence.
Cedric Layton said this is China's way to enter into direct competition with U.S. and other Western chip makers by quickly developing the infrastructure required for quickly developing processing speeds at smaller devices, much as they did in developing cheaper industrial products. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said the relevant accusations are pure fiction and totally fabricated. Coming up, a look at next week's American election. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Indonesian search and rescue workers believe they have found the fuselage of a Lion Air passenger jet that crashed with 189 people on board. They're also trying to confirm the origin of an underwater ping signal. Ground staff lost touch with flight JT610 of the Indonesian budget airline Lion Air 13 minutes after the Boeing 737 MAX 8 took off early on Monday from Jakarta. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. VOA Asia continues with less than 1 week to go before the crucial U.S. midterm congressional election. Americans are on edge after a massacre at a Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh and the arrest of a man charged with sending pipe bombs to prominent Democrats. Voters will elect a new Congress on November 6th, and the results could shift the balance of power in Washington and have a profound impact on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the final days of the midterm campaign from Washington.
In Pittsburgh, a tearful vigil for the victims of the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. From President Trump, a condemnation of violence and a plea for unity.
We condemn the historic evil of anti-Semitism and every other form of evil. And unfortunately, evil comes in many forms. And we come together as one American people.
The synagogue shooting and the arrest of a man charged with sending pipe bombs to prominent Democrats and Trump critics have heightened tensions and uncertainty in the final days of the midterm campaign, says analyst John Hudak.
Well, the country is in pain. This is a set of circumstances that unfortunately happens in America all too regularly, that is acts of violence and acts of aggression toward fellow Americans by Americans.
Hey folks, how are you?
Former Vice President Joe Biden is among those calling for calm.
I know sometimes these days the anger, the hatred, the viciousness seem like they're going to overwhelm us. And it's on our leaders to set the tone, to dial down the temperature, to restore some dignity to our national dialogue.
A vote for Democrats is also a vote to destroy Medicare.
Some Democrats say the president's partisan attacks have contributed to the politically charged atmosphere. Not true, says White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders.
The very first thing the media did was blame the president and make him responsible for these ridiculous acts. That is outrageous that would be the very first reaction.
For his part, Trump has vowed to campaign aggressively right up to Election Day on issues important to his supporters, like immigration.
The Democrat Party is openly encouraging millions of illegal aliens to break our laws, violate our borders, and bankrupt our country. That's what has to happen.
I did 50 town halls. You know what people talked about in those town halls? Health care.
Democrats have focused on health care for much of the campaign, but Trump also looms large, says Jim Kessler.
Democrats want to make this about health care and the tax bill and about Donald Trump. And let's face it, this is going to be about Donald Trump.
You all ready?
Democrats expect to make gains in the House of Representatives, but Republicans are favored to hold their narrow majority in the Senate, says John Fortier.
And some of what has happened in recent days with the Kavanaugh hearings and Republicans kind of coming home as a party are helping in that area. So it'll be mostly a win for Democrats, but with a probably bright spot in the Senate for Republicans.
The stakes are enormous. A Democratic House could block the Trump agenda and launch numerous investigations of the Trump White House, complicating the president's re-election hopes in 2020. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia. India celebrated the unveiling Wednesday of a towering statue of one of the country's key independence figures. Prime Minister Narendra Modi was on hand in his home state of Gujarat for the inauguration of the Statue of Unity, a depiction of Sardar Patel that rises 182 meters high, nearly twice the height of New York's Statue of Liberty. It is now the world's tallest statue. Now on VOA Asia, a just-released report from the World Wildlife Fund details a rapid decline in the world's biodiversity. In general, the percentages of all kinds of animals in the land, sea, and air have declined rapidly since 1970. VOA's Kevin Enochs reports.
The statistics are stark and alarming, according to the just-released Living Planet report from the World Wildlife Fund. The fund's Nick Sarin lays out the numbers.
Populations of mammals, of birds, of fish declined between 1970 and the year 2014 by 60% globally. And in freshwater habitats, the figure is some 83%. That's a phenomenal rate of decline.
And the head of the WWF Forests Unit, Carrie Cesario, says it's no surprise that our continuing impact on the planet bears much of the blame.
Human activity is the driver of the declines we're seeing, primarily our demand, our increasing demand for food, energy, water.
That activity is driving climate change. But the report's authors say there are lessons we can learn from how the world came together to act on curbing greenhouse gases.
When we think about how the world responded to the climate threat and forged a pact in Paris in 2015 to address climate change, we need a similar deal at the global level for people and nature.
Cesario points to success stories like the giant panda's recovery and the rising population of tigers in the wild as proof that what is happening is reversible.
While the report is very sobering, I think the message is also that it's not too late to course correct. Life is resilient. It bounces back, and so if we take concerted action, we can reverse these trends and ensure a living planet for future generations.
To help life bounce back, the World Wildlife Fund is calling on governments to sign onto a Convention on Biological Diversity in 2020. It creates a pathway to conserve the world's wild places and reverse the planet's shrinking biodiversity.
It has set targets for things like percentage of area to be protected under parks and indigenous reserves and other types of community conserved areas.
The WWF says when everything the Earth provides us in terms of food, lumber, energy, and other resources are tabulated, the planet's worth is about $125 trillion a year. The goal now is to find a way to make all that rich natural biodiversity sustainable and available for generations to come. Kevin Enochs, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Greg Burns, our managing editor Diane Gao, and our team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.